From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson at NPR Election Headquarters in Washington.
I'm Robin Young. This is a special edition of Here and Now, hours after an historic election. President Obama has invited President-elect Donald Trump to the White House tomorrow. Here is Obama speaking from the White House Rose Garden this afternoon.
Now, it is no secret that the President-elect and I have some pretty significant differences. But remember, 8 years ago, President Bush and I had some pretty significant differences. But President Bush's team could not have been more professional or more gracious in making sure we had a smooth transition so that we could hit the ground running.
And last night, Donald Trump's message was unity.
For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
So how exactly did Donald Trump win? Well, Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR political reporter, has been looking through the numbers and joins us right now. First of all, Danielle, it appears that Clinton could well and may well win the popular vote.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that is not official yet at all, so just be aware of that. But as of 2 p.m., right before I came into the studio, with 92% of precincts reporting, and this is according to CNN's numbers, Clinton was up by around 200,000. That is a tiny margin out of, you know, around 120 million votes between her and Donald Trump.
So one of Trump's key constituencies has been white, less educated voters. What did the exit polls show?
It showed a really, really big gulf among this group. I mean, it was pretty amazing. If you look at white voters as a whole, it looks like whites preferred Romney by about 20 points in 2012, and they preferred Trump by around 20 points to Clinton this year. However, within that group of whites, you had a big gap. College-educated whites appear to have slightly preferred Trump by around 4 points, according to exit polls. Now, that is different from what a lot of polls said. A lot of people were saying, you know, Trump might lose white college-educated voters for the first time. The Republicans have lost them in decades. Mm-hmm. So that's 4 points for Trump. But then you look at non-college-educated whites. They were 39 points in favor of Trump over Clinton. Now, that so you have a total 35-point gap. The gap in 2012 was 12 points. So Trump tripled the gap from 2012. That is just gargantuan.
And meanwhile, Clinton did not get the numbers from the Obama coalition of African-American voters, millennials, that she had hoped for.
Right. Totally true. I mean, so you look at these numbers and at first it looks pretty great for her. I mean, there's an 80-point gap among black voters, like 8% of them for Trump, 88% for her. However, Obama won 93% of black voters, and also exit polls seem to be suggesting that black turnout was slightly down this year. Likewise, Obama won 71% of Latinos. Clinton, exit polls show 65. Now, there's a margin of error on these, of course. This may not be perfectly exact. But what it does seem to say is that, you know, Clinton certainly didn't overperform with Latinos, which is surprising.
And then there is, of course, the issue of gender and women voters. Here's Clinton this morning talking about failing to become the first female president twice.
This is painful, and it will be for a long time. But I want you to remember this. Our campaign was never about one person or even one election. It was about the country we love and about building an America that's hopeful, inclusive, and big-hearted.
Danielle, how did women vote?
Women voted for Clinton, really overall, broadly speaking, about like they voted for President Obama in 2012. Women preferred Clinton by 12 points this year. They preferred Obama by 11 points last time. The story here appears to be men. Men preferred Romney by around 7 points in 2012. It looks like Trump almost doubled that among men. So men really swung towards Trump. And, you know, white men in particular really liked him. And white non-college educated men were some of his absolutely staunchest supporters. And they showed up, you know, in big numbers for him.
That's Danielle Kurtzleben, an NPR political reporter, looking through the numbers, the exit polls about who voted. Danielle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What's a perfect segue, Jeremy, to Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University in Wisconsin, because she's also co-author of Women and the White House, Gender, Popular Culture, and Presidential Politics, and she's at WUMW in Milwaukee. Lily, professor, what do you think happened? What happened last night?
Well, you know, I think, again, that there's a lot of discussion about the novelty of a woman running for the presidency. And you know, of my research and the research of lots of other people have indicated that this is, you know, this is an office that is often defined by, you know, sort of a male understanding of power. And so part of that was probably in play to a degree. But it's also, you know, as you've just had the discussion about white men in particular coming out in bigger numbers than they have in the past is a contributing force with regard to the ultimate results in the polls, particularly in the states in the Electoral College.
Well, but why were they coming out? I mean, just we tick off some of the reasons. I've mentioned earlier today, what stays with me is a man I heard speak in West Virginia who was very concerned about the nation's security. And he said, other countries will not respect a woman. We need a tough guy. And yeah, Donald Trump says crazy things, but that will scare other countries. And we have real national security issues right now with ISIS and you know, other things happening around the world. A woman can't handle that.
Well, you know, certainly there are some of the perspectives with regard to whether or not a woman can handle, you know, being the commander in chief in the United States. And again, it's an individual who's running for the office in a lot of parliamentary systems. You're running as part of a party. And so we've seen women as prime ministers in a lot of other countries because they're coming through a different kind of system. And so part of it is you are, in fact, you know, choosing to elect or not elect a woman to the White House. And I think that's part of it. You know, I don't want to call it a glass ceiling, but I think that there is some question about that sort of barrier with regard to the expectations of the people who will be in that office and the kinds of decisions that they have to make. And, you know, we're used to, we've had 44 and now we'll have 45 men who have occupied that office.
Yeah.
Lily Gorin, a lot of people leading up to this day had been thinking that the conversation we'd be having today was what happens to the Republican Party now. I want to ask you, what happens to the Democratic Party now, and who's the leader of it right now?
Well, I mean, there's you know, early days in sort of the autopsy discussion, but certainly one of the leaders will likely be in some form or fashion the outgoing president, President Obama. But there's also a lot of discussion with regard to, you know, who's on the bench, who's next, and who are the incoming leaders, potential leaders who are either in state houses or mayors or in the Senate or the House. And, you know, you do have sort of an older generation of Democrats that we saw that from the first, you know, from the Bill Clinton administration, and a lot of the folks who have also been leaders in the House and the Senate have been, many of them have been there for a while, and so there is a conversation of where they're going to come from and which states they're going to come from too. You know, you do see sort of Hillary Clinton's strengths and the Democratic Party's strengths with regard to a lot of the coastal states. And you have, you know, sort of consistency, at least in a number of places, with regard to Democrats holding offices in a lot of those states in various forms.
I was going to jump in and say who you are. You're Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University in Wisconsin, but also co-author of Women and the White House, Gender, Popular Culture, and Presidential Politics. And I want to jump back into some of the questions. We, you know, spoke about Hillary Clinton, perhaps her gender being an issue. Every time we do that, and I know Jeremy is nodding, that people write in and say it has nothing to do with it being a woman. It's this woman that they did not want to vote for. But how is it that we have a man who's just won the office of president after he bragged on audio tape about sexually assaulting women, you know, grabbing them by their private parts, and maybe in court in December facing an allegation of rape of a 13, 14-year-old, I believe. You know, now I know people on the other, you know, people who are backing Donald Trump will say, well, they felt the same way about Bill Clinton. They didn't understand how Democrats couldn't see those flaws. But this is someone who's been elected with people knowing those flaws. What do you know about popular culture? What are you seeing there?
Well, again, you know, you see images in popular culture and you see watching television, going to the movies, see them in video games, and you still have a lot of sort of conflicting messages and understandings of, you know, what women are capable of, what their role is. There was a lot of discussion, of course, during the campaign itself with regard to Hillary Clinton's responsibility for Bill Clinton's extracurricular activities, shall we say. And you know, what is the role? What is our expectation with regard to women in marriages?
What we should say, just one of us to say, there were also allegations of rape against Bill Clinton, unproven.
Yes.
But just to, you know, extracurricular, yes, is a little broader than that for some people. But go ahead.
But again, it's, you know, the question of how we understand a sort of gender dynamics and, you know, the capacities of women, what their roles are, not only at home, but also in, you know, the public sphere, in their careers, in holding offices, not elected, yeah, office, not only elected offices, but corner offices in Fortune 500 companies. There are very few women,
yeah. Yeah.
In those positions.
Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by about 120,000 votes in North Carolina last night, and a Republican incumbent there is heading back to the U.S. Senate. But the governor's race, that's too close to call and likely headed for a recount. Jeff Tiberi from Here and Now contributor WUNC has more.
More than 4.5 million people cast ballots in North Carolina, and the two major party candidates for governor are separated by just a few thousand votes. Incumbent Republican Governor Pat McCrory and Democratic challenger Roy Cooper are likely heading for a recount. Early this morning in Raleigh, each candidate struck a different tone.
Because of your hard work, we have won this race for governor of North Carolina.
Minutes before Cooper declared victory, a few miles away, McCrory offered this.
The process is continuing right here in North Carolina. The election is not over in North Carolina. That's why we've delayed coming out here. Let me tell you where we're at right now.
He says the State Board of Elections will now canvass those general election provisional ballots. Results will take at least another 9 days. McCrory has received national criticism in recent months over the controversial so-called bathroom bill, which discriminates against the LGBT community. Meanwhile, voters have given Republican Richard Burr a third term in the U.S. Senate. He celebrated with a crowd in Winston-Salem.
This is a victory for all those who have believed in me and who have continued to have confidence in the fact that my values match your values, and that for that I'm grateful.
Burr was not seen as vulnerable a year ago. Then this race got close. The so-called experts had it pegged as a toss-up, but Burr prevailed. He benefited from Donald Trump's strong swing state showing and defeated challenger Deborah Ross.
We've met people who have been struggling, who need to have the minimum wage increased. We've met older people who cannot make ends meet just on Social Security and Medicare. We've seen what the needs are of the state of North Carolina, and I am hoping and praying that this next Congress will address them.
With Republicans maintaining control of the U.S. House and Senate and taking back the White House, changes to Social Security and Medicare could be coming, just not what Ross and other Democrats would like to see. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tiberi in Durham, North Carolina.
Well, we're checking with voters that we met on our election road trip, but one we've checked in with for years is Toni Halla. She owns the Canterbury store in Canterbury, New Hampshire, a staunch Republican. But when we spoke during the primaries, she was struggling with who to vote for.
For the first time in my life, I'm not sure. I'm disappointed that I'm disappointed in all of it this time.
Toni joins us from the Canterbury store. You are always the most feisty and convinced Republican we'd meet.
Yes.
You were not this time, but you ended up supporting Donald Trump.
I did.
How are you feeling today?
I'm shell-shocked. I was convinced Mrs. Clinton was going to win. And I didn't watch anything last night. I had college football, whatever game on. And then my husband called me first thing in the morning and said, quoted Al Michaels in the Dream Team when we beat Russia in the Olympics. Al Michaels said, "Do you believe in miracles?" And that's what my husband said to me on the phone.
But are you convinced that...
I'm scared to death.
Why? Why?
He's a loose cannon. I don't even know what he's about.
Well, so, I mean, but this, you know how this sounds to people who say, well, you think he's a loose cannon. Mm-hmm. We do, too. And
I
you
know.
Helped put him in office.
We have that. And I'm very surprised. I did not expect this. I think it's probably because we're so disaffected. Is that the proper use of mm-hmm. everybody is so voters always have to have a whipping boy. And that was Mrs. Clinton.
Well, so do you think that there might be other voters like you who voted for Donald Trump to make a statement about how unhappy you are?
Yes, absolutely.
And now are maybe worried?
Slightly worried, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And what about your party, Tony? I mean, how does it...
What a mess, huh? What a mess.
How does your other favorite candidate, Mitt Romney, when he ran, how does he now work together with somebody he tried to defeat?
Oh, boy. Speaking of parties, it's going to be... After the speech last night that Donald Trump was gracious, and I think he has some maturity and such in him, and I think there might be hope after all. We have to do a lot of house cleaning and maintenance, and, well, a lot of people do house cleaning. They buy a house that's falling down, and they fix it up.
So that's your hope.
That is.
Well, Tony Halla of the Canterbury Country Store in New Hampshire, we'll see in 4 years.
Okay, it's a plan, Robin. Thanks a lot.
Well, as Republicans respond to their unexpected victory, Democrats absorb their loss. One guy has to figure out how to work it all into the Bluff the Listener segment. We're referring, of course, to Peter Sagal, host of NPR's news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So, Peter, how will you play it out?
Play what out?
Oh, there was this election last night, and...
were just going to mention that, you know, roundup of the news at the end. No, it's funny. You actually mentioned the Bluff the Listener segment. We actually, as we started talking about this week's show, we actually considered doing our Bluff the Listener segment with three stories, only one of which is real, even though it's incredible and unbelievable. And the real one would have been Donald Trump being elected president. You know, one of these stories is true. We decided not to do that. We are going to, embrace the challenge of this very interesting week and do what we usually do, which is say rude things about our betters and then move on to stories involving weird studies and misbehaving animals.
Right. Yeah. Well, Peter, as Robin pointed out, a lot of Republicans are very happy today and a lot of Democrats are very worried and scared. I just wonder if you had some advice to people out there who really are upset today about what has happened, about how to kind of get through this. You're
the entire
on-staff psychiatrist, yes.
That a public radio game show host would be able to soothe the terror of approximately half the nation is hilarious. I can tell you what I think my job is, which is not to make things actually better for those who want to want them to be better, but to make them feel better for about an hour or I think 52 minutes with fundraising breaks. The one of the things that we were all thinking about today, and obviously the analogy is not exact, is the show we did after 9/11, which was, of course, a catastrophe for the entire country, not about half of it. And we, at that time, the show was on the air, this we had a much smaller audience, we really wondered if anybody would ever like want to hear jokes about the news again. But we went ahead and we did our show. And it wasn't a very good show, but it was our show. And people wrote in and they expressed a tremendous amount of gratitude for giving them a break. The news had been so unpleasant and serious that, you know, for us to make our silly jokes about it was a relief. So I see my role as not necessarily solving any problems, but maybe happily distracting people.
Well,
for
I just
hour.
Have to say, you're not comparing the election of Donald Trump to 9/11. Although, you know, some analysts last night were saying that as far as intra-American moments, you know, not that terrible attack from outside the country, but intra-American moments, Mark Halperin put this up there with the Civil War and World War II. That it's that much of an earthquake.
I qualified the comparison before.
Yeah. Yes, you did.
And I could go further. For example, no one has yet died. However, what I was really referring to was the emotional toll on those who feel it. In that the thing about 9/11, and I think you guys were both around then, you seem mature, is that it really changed everybody's understanding of what was possible. in this world. It completely shook. I remember this feeling very vividly. It completely shook, like, the parameters of what I consider to be reality, you know? I mean, the world spun and the Twin Towers stood there and planes did not fly into them and knock them down and kill lots of people. And it was really scary to know that the world that I had believed I lived in was not the one that existed. And I think for a lot of people, if you talk about the political world of America, they feel the same. And I guess some of them are very happy about it, but mm-hmm. I'm sure there are a lot of people, again, roughly about half, who are feeling that extraordinary disorientation. And so the challenge for us is, in that narrow sense, the same, to give them a little break from feeling dizzy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter Sagal, host of the NPR News quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, thanks for joining us today.
Well, my pleasure.
Can't
Thanks
wait to
for
see
having
what
me.
You do. Can't wait.
Oh, if you have any ideas, send them.
quickly. They do the show on Thursdays.
Exactly. We've got about 24 hours. So all your clever japes, please send them in.
Sending right away. Robin, we do want to bring people up to date on some of the other races that are going on. Of course, we've been talking about the presidential race, but when you look through the Senate races, it does appear that the Republicans will keep the Senate with 51 to 47 at least. That's as of this morning. John McCain winning in Arizona, Marco Rubio winning in Florida, Tammy Duckworth, the Democrat, winning in the state of Illinois, Todd Young beating Evan Bayh in Indiana, Roy Blunt beating Jason Kander, who a lot of people thought would win in Missouri. Catherine Cortez Masto out in Nevada beating Joe Heck. And in New Hampshire at this hour, we still don't know who the winner of that race between Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan is going to be.
And we're going to be taking a look at there's so much else that was going on yesterday. The ballot questions across the country, marijuana legalization, 1 in 4 out of 5 states. So we're going to take a look at that.
At least 3 out of 5 states. I think we're still waiting on Maine,
right,
where it is very close on that. But yes, a big win for marijuana. And we'll be following all the results today right here on Here and Now. Lots to talk about today as Donald Trump's election continues to reverberate and people wondering what comes next. Top of the list is the future of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And for more on that, Dylan Scott joins us. He's Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication. Hi, Dylan.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
So what happens to Obamacare? Now Trump has promised to repeal and replace it.
Yeah, Republicans have been campaigning for 6 years on repealing and replacing Obamacare, and now they're going to have the opportunity to make a run at it, and I think there's every reason to think that they will. They're already talking about it this morning. The tricky thing will be, it's easy to say you're going to repeal this law. The hard part is actually doing it. 20 million people have gained health coverage under it. There are a lot of popular provisions, like letting kids stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26 years old. And so we don't yet have a great picture of how the Republicans will actually go about replacing in that repeal and replace equation.
Well, before you even get to the replacing part, one of the things Republicans have said is, well, we'll keep the things that people like. We'll keep the thing where you can stay on your parents' insurance until a certain age. We'll keep the ban on bumping people from their insurance for pre-existing conditions. Is it possible to repeal Obamacare and keep those things in place?
It might be. The tricky thing will be they're going to have to use some very archaic Senate procedures to get this thing passed. There's been reporting in the last year that shows they've started gaming out how to do that. But it's a very complicated process. It's going to be, you know, we're not going to know probably until early next year exactly what form that replace plan is going to take. I would think it will try to incorporate some of those provisions, as you say, that people like and that are popular and that Republicans have admitted are popular. But we're really in the dark in a lot of ways about exactly what form this Republican plan is going to take.
And of course, ironically, this plan was a Republican plan. It came from the Heritage Foundation and it copied the plan that Mitt Romney, when he was governor in Massachusetts, put forth in that state in order to get more people covered and to fix the healthcare system there. What might replace Obamacare?
That's a great question. Republicans have talked a lot about, well, we can get rid of the exchanges, we can block grant Medicaid, and if we let insurers sell their plans across state state lines, if we shore up these high-risk pools for sick people that will allow them to get some sort of health coverage, that'll mitigate all these millions of people who are going to lose their health insurance if Obamacare is repealed. Now that theory is going to be put to the test.
What happens to the 20 million people who have gotten coverage under the Affordable Care Act?
That remains to be seen. Republicans often have talked a lot recently about changing the tax code to make it easier for people to write off their health insurance and, in theory, make it more affordable. I think they would argue that's one way to make sure that the people who are currently buying insurance on the marketplaces are able to keep coverage. Again, these are scenarios that we've been talking about a lot recently in the last couple of years, but I don't know that we've really gamed out exactly what the fallout is going to be if those plans get implemented.
And just very briefly, do you believe that drug companies and insurance companies are going to be in favor of repealing and replacing?
That's going to be what really interesting to watch. The whole healthcare industry has been invested in the Affordable Care Act for the last 6 years. They might not have liked parts of it, but they did sign up. You know, they got on board with it. And so how they approach this is going to be really interesting.
That's Dylan Scott, a Washington correspondent for STAT. Dylan, thanks.
Thank you.
Indiana's contested Senate seat will stay with the Republicans as Congressman Todd Young took an easy victory over longtime Democrat Evan Bayh. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek has more on what led to Bayh's 10-point loss.
Indiana Democrats pulled out all the stops to try and win this Senate race. In July, they replaced their initial candidate, former Congressman Barron Hill, with someone they thought could beat the hard-right third-term congressman from Bloomington, Todd Young. That someone was Evan Bayh, a former governor here and multi-term senator, and the son of Birch Bayh, another former senator who authored major civil rights legislation in the 1960s and 70s. But this race ended with Young declaring victory.
This seat belongs to the Hoosiers who are struggling to pay for increasing health care premiums. They're furious at their government, which has left them in this situation.
For many, Evan Bayh had become part of that Washington establishment. He was popular with Indiana labor unions and educators, but in 2010, after a decade in the Senate, he made an abrupt exit from state politics to go work as a consultant for a D.C. lobbying firm. That gave Bayh a tough reputation to overcome, say supporters like Justin Allen.
He's viewed as kind of an insider. He's won a lot of elections before, so I just don't think that helps somebody like Evan Bayh.
Bayh's early lead eroded steadily under an onslaught from Republicans. The Senate campaign wound up costing $60 million, much of it spent on attack ads about Bayh's lobbying days and his support of policies such as the Affordable Care Act. Those ads paid off in the end, earning Todd Young 52% of the Hoosier vote to Bayh's 42%. In his concession speech, the first of his political career, Bayh asked supporters to come together with those who voted the other way.
Because at this critical hour, America needs unity more than anything else.
Evan Bayh's loss was one of several that kept Senate control out of reach for Democrats. So in January, Todd Young will return to Washington on the majority side of the aisle. He'll work with now senior Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly, a Democrat who will face his first re-election bid in 2018. For Here and Now, I'm Annie Ropeek in Indianapolis.
Last night, Donald Trump won, but Hillary Clinton has millions of devoted supporters who've backed her for years. We met Cindy Passion in Ames, Iowa, knocking on doors for her during the caucuses. Cindy joins us. And Cindy, not just a loss, but one of the most stunning in American history. How are you today?
Not too good. Yeah, I just got off the phone with my mom, and she was crying, and my daughters are very scared and angry.
Why? What do they think? How do you feel about what might happen?
My youngest daughter lives in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I think she's concerned about gays and lesbians, people who are different, people who are on the outside, and it's very upsetting to them.
What do you think happened? The Trump campaign says they felt it turn around 2 weeks ago when news came that a percentage of people on Obamacare would see their premiums shoot up. There was the late game announcement of a possible email scandal. And Hillary Clinton had one of the most, you know, unfavorable ratings of any candidate, which I know backers like you find perplexing, but do you think she was just a flawed candidate? What do you think happened?
I don't think she's a flawed candidate at all. I think she's completely qualified. And, I mean, I first met her in 2007. She was so warm to me and my daughter, and I just thought, you know, how can people say these things about her? I have about 8 female friends who ran for the Iowa legislature and then two women that I know not quite as well who ran for Congress in Iowa, and they all lost to men.
Do you think there's some kind of backlash going on? I mean,
that's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid it's a very anti-woman. It really scares me.
Well, Cindy, it's a tough time for Hillary Clinton supporters. And yet, you know, we go forward as Americans. Can you support a Trump presidency?
He's who we got, you know. I mean, we got a lot of work to do. He's got his work cut out for him. He's got divisions within his own party, you know. Everything is just different.
Yeah. Cindy Passion, a Hillary Clinton supporter in Ames, Iowa. Cindy, thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate talking to you.
And let's bring back in Lily Gorin, a professor of political science at Carroll University in Wisconsin. She's co-author of Women in the White House, Gender, Popular Culture, and Presidential Politics. She's with us from WUWM. Lily, let's talk about Wisconsin in the presidential race. Very surprising that it would go for Donald Trump, or was it surprising to you?
Well, you know, if you look at some of the other states that hadn't gone for Republican in quite some time that are our neighbors when we're talking about Michigan and Pennsylvania, you can see, you know, some of the trend with regard to white rural and sort of the white vote in general. But you also have, if you look at the not only the presidential race, but also the Senate race, where you had Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, sort of a rematch of their race 6 years ago. And the polling, you know, again, the polling suggested both at the presidential level and until the very end, also at the Senate race, that the Democrats were going to carry Wisconsin. And in the end, they did not. You know, and particularly with regard to the Senate race, Mr. Johnson performed better than Mr. Trump did, but both of them carried Wisconsin for the Republicans.
What do you think happened with the polling, that it was so wrong? How did everyone miss this?
I don't know. And again, there's a lot of discussion about how many polls there were, because there were fewer polls this presidential cycle than had been in the past. A lot of polls in the past had been done by newspapers. A lot of those newspapers don't have the funds to do polls. There's a question of the kinds of polls themselves, whether they were online, and how they, you know, how they weighted the sample. So there's a lot of questions with regard to the state polls. The national poll, you know, which had it as a, you know, a sort of a tight race, and now we see that there may be Hillary Clinton with actually the popular vote total ahead of Trump, but Trump with the Electoral College vote total is more reflective to some degree of those national polls. But the state by state polls, at least in the ones that I was looking at that were coming out for Wisconsin and elsewhere, were showing Hillary Clinton in a lot of places with leads that she apparently didn't have.
Right. Well, when you look at these two campaigns, now that we can look back on these two campaigns, you've got one campaign, the Clinton campaign, which was run, it seemed, from the outside, very smoothly. They had the big ground game. They were spending a lot of money on ads. They were very careful. She wasn't out there off script all that much. You had the Trump campaign, the complete opposite. Everyone said he doesn't have any ground game. They're not planning out exactly what he is going to do in a way that a typical campaign would. How do you look at what worked and what didn't in these campaigns at this point?
Well, again, you know, this is what happens after every presidential election, and after oftentimes, you know, other like statewide elections, is, you know, what worked and what didn't. And I think one of the novelties, if you will, with regard to this particular election cycle was that Donald Trump also used to his advantage a lot of the media. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion we could have about, you know, the media's role in everything. But Donald Trump was on television, at least with his voice, you know, calling in all the time. People were hearing him and seeing him a lot. And he wasn't necessarily, again, his campaign, or he wasn't paying for that media. And so there's a lot of discussion with regard to the fact that he was sort of this blanket in the media. And Clinton certainly did not have as much media time, and a lot of the time that she was, in fact, in front of the media, it was with regard to scandals or controversies. That may be part of what, you know, was sort of going on that's different in this particular campaign cycle than in previous ones.
Donald Trump has talked about some of the things he'd like to do as soon as he becomes president. Obviously, the big one, build the wall, repeal and replace Obamacare, ban Muslims from entering this country, rip up trade deals and things like that. Given the fact that it appears Hillary Clinton is going to win the popular vote, how much of a mandate is he going to have?
You know, mandate's a sort of tricky term. And so you have a discussion here also not only of what Trump has articulated on the campaign trail, and these are the things that he's, you know, that we can all sort of say. We heard him say that lots of times. But he also has a Republican Congress, and he is the Republican president. And there are quite a few also Republican state houses. And so what you have is, you know, sort of a unified government. And this is the opportunity to move forward with a lot of the agenda items that he has identified, as well as, you know, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan have identified as issues that they would like to move forward with a, you know, with somebody in the White House who will then sign the legislation into fact.
That's Lily Gorin, a professor of political science at Carroll University in Wisconsin. Lily, thanks for being with us this hour.
Sure, my pleasure.
World leaders are reacting to Donald Trump's election. Russian President Vladimir Putin, one of the first and the warmest, drawing applause in the Russian parliament and saying he's ready for full relations to be restored. You remember right now there are sanctions against Russia for interference in Ukraine. But French President François Hollande tweeted that Trump's win opens up a period of uncertainty. Lise Doucette is the BBC's chief international correspondent. Lise, on the campaign trail, Trump talked about banning refugees, breaking trade deals, saying the U.S. wouldn't protect countries in NATO if they didn't start paying more. So with that backdrop, what strikes you about world leader reaction?
I think many around the world are pondering today that quintessential question about politicians. Should we give much weight to whatever they say on the campaign trail? Because often politicians promise one thing and do another. But this is a very different kind of election campaign and a very different kind of candidate. Donald Trump is not a politician. He likes to present himself as a very successful economic a businessman. He was, of course, a reality television star. He is possibly one of the most inexperience, at least in terms of the world of politics and government, to enter the White House. So if we take him at his word, then I think many leaders, but not all leaders around the world, will be different, will be very worried, because America's place in the world in terms of some key transatlantic alliances like NATO, in terms of some key international cooperation like working for climate change, working for to keep the Iran deal working, will no longer be in place. Mm-hmm. But when he gets to the White House in January, working within the American system, working with the Republican establishment, when he engages with the world, will his policies be different than what he said on the campaign trail?
Well, in fact, with that in mind, the EU officials wrote him a letter with congratulations, but also a request that he come visit as soon as possible to explain what he does mean about migrants, climate change, which Donald Trump has said he doesn't believe in and it doesn't believe is man-made, if there is any, about Russia and its interference in Ukraine. But here's what Donald Trump said early in his victory speech. Let's listen.
I want to tell the world community that while we will always put America's interests first, we will deal fairly with everyone, all people and all other nations.
So this tone, as you say, it's a completely different tone than we heard on the campaign trail, may assuage a little bit. But what are some of the other concerns? Is there a concern that he'll pull back from NATO or that Russia will feel more empowered in Syria, where it backs the President Assad?
I think we just don't know, because we know his statements in the heat of an election campaign, and some of his statements were modified. For example, when he first talked about banning all Muslims, which caused great consternation in predominantly Muslim countries around the world, caused consternation among Muslims living in the United States. That was then changed to extreme vetting. And there already is extreme vetting or very serious vetting of people who come from other countries into the United States of America. So what we're hearing today, as you always do in the aftermath of an election, You have Donald Trump saying he's going to reach out to the rest of the world and treat them fairly, in a sense talking about building bridges instead of building walls. And you have leaders around the world putting on a brave face. But remember, there are leaders around the world, and you would have to include Russia's President Vladimir Putin and the Chinese leaders in this equation, who basically didn't feel American policies were working. They didn't want to work with Hillary Clinton because that would have been a continuation of Barack Obama, plus even more interventionist, an even more hawkish view. Now they will have a new person in the White House, a new person who has said things that have pleased them during the election campaign. And so they see the possibility for a new start. So we can't look at this in terms of a zero-sum game for the rest of the world. But perhaps it's not a coincidence that those who have been largely welcoming of Donald Trump are those who would like to see a less engaged America, a weaker America in the rest of the world. Those who are really concerned are those who see American leadership, a strong America, as better for a stronger international order, which can do trade deals, which can tackle climate change, which can work together to tackle threats like the so-called Islamic State.
Lise, just very briefly, is this seen on that side of the pond as the equivalent of Brexit, Britain's kind of the heck with you to the rest of the European Union, which some people are having Brexit regret?
It is a backlash, if you like. It's a backlash against elites, a backlash against a world which is not giving many millions of people around the world the kind of future they want. So the United States, when it comes to foreign policy, had to choose between possibly the woman who was the most experienced ever candidate to run for the White House, in a sense, a woman who knew a lot about the world, and instead they chose a man who, in effect, it's because of his own history, knows very little about the world. So let us see how that experience will change him and what mark he will put on the world. And, of course, that will be America's mark.
Lise Doucet, the BBC's chief international correspondent. Lise, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And this is our special coverage of an historic election, Donald Trump becoming the first American president not to have held either a military or a government office. And so we are bringing you this special coverage.
And by the way, it's going to be very interesting to see. President Obama is supposed to go to Europe, I believe, next week. It will be very interesting to see how that goes, given what's just happened.
He might bump into Donald Trump over there as
maybe.
Well.
Maybe. Yeah. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WVUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.